Our question today, what do you think of the government's proposed law on assisted dying?
C'est important d'appeler les choses par leur nom. On parlera pas d'euthanasie et de suicide assisté parce que c'est des mots violents et que c'est des mots
difficiles. Wie hat Schriftsteller Wolfgang Herrndorf geschrieben? Ich muss wissen, dass ich Herr im eigenen Haus bin. Weiter nichts.
Es el caso paradigmático de cómo la cultura puede tener un enorme poder para hacer a una sociedad mejor.
Assisted, the podcast. An original production by Assisted Lab, a nonpartisan research project about assisted dying.
My name is Vanessa Rampton. I'm from Assisted Lab, and today I'm talking to Daniel Weinstock, who is a professor of law at McGill University, Canada, the Catherine A. Pearson Chair in Civil Society and Public Policy. And Daniel, your research interests are very varied. As I understand them, they kind of contribute to different domains in practical philosophy and also provide kind of foundational thinking and reasoning to various public policy issues, one of which is assisted dying. So thanks so much for talking to us today. I want to go back in time to ask you about an experience you had more than a decade ago as a member of the Royal Society of Canada expert panel on end-of-life decision-making. Yeah. And just to ask you how you came to be involved in that expert committee and maybe also a little bit about your experience of that process.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was not something that I had been expecting to have happen. I got a cold call or a cold email, I can't remember which one, from the person who I didn't know at the time, who was going to chair the committee, a bioethicist by the name of Udo Schuklenk, who holds the Ontario Research Chair in Bioethics at Queen's University. And he had been asked by the Royal Society to put together a committee that would write a report. So the Royal Society of Canada is an independent learned society, which on occasion, every couple of years, decides on the basis of its own decisions about how it can best contribute to Canadian public policy issues that it should have a panel on this issue, that issue. I can't remember what came immediately after, but immediately before, but very, very different from what we were. So Udo had been asked to, as one of Canada's most prominent bioethicists, he'd been asked to chair this commission and put together a group. The group was going to be composed of different types of expertise, both clinical, population health, and philosophical slash ethical. We also thought it was important to have people who had contributed to debates in societies outside of Canada, one where medical assistance in dying had been institutionalized and one in which it was still in debate. So that ended up being the Netherlands on the one hand and the UK on the other. So it was a complete surprise. I wasn't expecting it because my publishing record didn't really include anything on medical assistance in dying. I'd actually organized an event. I ran a research center at the University of Montreal in ethics, and a friend of mine was just starting a similar research center at Carleton University in Ottawa, and he wanted to get a couple of events off the ground to get the name of his center a little bit of recognition. And he suggested that we organize an event. Now, this is probably shortly after the Rodriguez decision. This is probably sometime in the late 90s or something like that, that we organize an event, maybe the early 2000s, come to think of it, that we organize an event on medical assistance in dying. I'd never really thought about the issue academically, and I actually presented a paper, it was never published, in which I argued that there is a big step to be made in going from one's reactions to individual cases, right? Like the Sue Rodriguez case, which was the dominant case in people's minds, this very articulate, fully, clearly fully rational and competent woman who made an absolutely, refutable case for her own right to end her life on her own terms and at the time that she deemed appropriate. So everybody was thinking of her. And my argument was that let's be careful because, we're talking about societal policy rather than talking about an individual person. And there are problems, not necessarily insuperable problems, but problems in scaling up. So I think that on the basis of that one experience, there's a proposal that's out there in the sort of theoretical literature that says that the prohibition should be kept in the criminal law, but that individual cases should be granted constitutional exemptions. So that would treat the individual case without changing the general policy. And I had been probably inclined to think that that was the right way to go, you know, on the basis of my initial reflections. So I can't say that people who look at our report say sometimes that it was stacked by people who were clearly very favorable to MAID to start with. Certainly wasn't my case. So we sat for 2 years, and it was a wonderful experience. It was basically a division of labor where the eight of us, were there eight? There was a lawyer from Dalhousie, Justin Downey, who wrote a chapter on the legal context, prior decisions. There were the two European experts, Ross Upshur, who is one of the leading public health specialists in Canada, and Udo and myself, so more like six. And we divided up the work, but we also met quite regularly in order to make sure that we were sort of rowing in the same general direction. And it was very enriching and led me in many ways to change my mind, but in a kind of a cautious way. The report makes the argument that the door to physician-assisted dying should be opened fairly modestly. So the argument as I crafted it was that Canadian constitutional law and political culture has a very great commitment to individual autonomy, that people should be able to make decisions for themselves in the big issues of their lives, their jobs, their procreation, whether they have a partner or not, and what particular sexual orientation they have, that those things are important for people to decide for themselves. And the matter of one's dealing with terminal illness should be part of those decisions, not as a matter of fundamental philosophy, but as a matter of consistency with other areas where Canadians had already taken stand. So the idea was not to make a kind of a foundational argument that some people might disagree with, but to say, this just seems to be what makes the most sense given all the other commitments that we already have and feel strongly about, the ability of women to decide to and terminate pregnancies. But obviously autonomous decision-making requires a certain number of conditions to do with people's ability to competency and et cetera. And those were questions that we kind of punted into the future, thinking that to try to open the door more widely, and there were people, I think, on the committee who would have wanted that at the outset, would have probably been a little bit too ambitious given the state of public opinion at the time.
So I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned Sue Rodriguez, and as you know, for Assisted Lab, this question of stories is of fundamental importance to us. Were there other stories that were particularly relevant at the time? I know the report was published in 2011. There had been like the Robert Latimer case, the famous case of mercy killing. Yeah. I'm just wondering, in your almost even anecdotal experience, what do you feel were the stories that were influencing?
So the Latimer case was definitely part of the general environment. And I think that what a lot of us, certainly I can only speak for myself really, but I think that what the Latimer case provided us with was an example of the way medical assistance in dying should not occur. Absolutely. Right? That it shouldn't be just the fact of somebody empathetic and, you know, as he might have been towards his daughter suffering greatly, just taking matter into his own hands. You know, the thought that was that, you know, very much for me was that if we were going to have assistance in dying, it had to be as part of a medical process. It had to be at the end of a medical process where it's decided by a patient and physician that really there are no other alternatives that wouldn't cause undue suffering, et cetera. There's no realistic or reasonable prospect of improvement, but that this be done under medical conditions so that the death is actually a good death, a death that is done without any suffering with the aid of medical science. So the Latimer case was definitely in the background. I think everybody probably came to it. You know, one of the experiences that I had with the report after it was published, where we had to take to the media and defend it, was that there was hardly a single instance where during or after the interview, somebody, and it could be like somebody holding the mic, you know, come up to me and say, you know, my father, my brother, would have personal anecdotes. I had a story in my own family. My mother died as a result of kind of hidden medical assistance in dying. She was in the final stages of cancer. And one day at the end of the day, she was really suffering greatly. A young resident came up to me and said, your mother is suffering too much. We're going to up her pain medication. And I said, yeah, sure, of course. And he looked at me and said, you know, you understand what I'm saying, don't you? And all of a sudden, I realized that he was telling me that he was going to give my mother a dose that would probably arrest her breathing, which it did the next day. She died the next day. And I came out of that thinking that on the one hand, it was the right thing to do. But on the other hand, it was completely absurd that it needed to be that sort of, you know, he couldn't say what he was doing for fear of actually putting himself in legal jeopardy, right? Because it was still completely illegal. And that a case like my mother's, of which there are, you know, thousands and thousands every year in Canada, should be something that is above board, right? It should be something where people say, you know, this is too much for me, and given the available alternatives. So that was very much in my mind, that it was a kind of a, and in many ways unsatisfying, because by the time we'd, you know, returned to the hospital the next day, she was unconscious. And so, you know, we never had a chance to do what people do with medical assisted dying, which is kind of to organize a final farewell. So that was definitely something. It certainly motivated me to accept the invitation to be part of the committee, to think about, you know, the fact that certainly in my own case, the story was had the right ending, but not the right sort of final chapter, as it were. Right. And that was because of these excessively prohibitive laws.
Yeah, and in a way, I lost the opportunity for meaning making.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. For her and for the people that she left behind. And, you know, I think that story is completely banal in the sense of probably having been, you know, the way that a lot of people confronted their own deaths and the deaths of their loved ones in Canada before the law was changed. So, you know, I think everybody came into it. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. Whether, you know, the people on the committee had other kind of personal reasons. We didn't want to personalize it, but it was certainly this, you know, it was certainly in the back of my mind as I decided that, you know, I needed to give this some thought in the context of this report.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right to point to the way in which, you know, practices used to happen, and to fast forward a little bit to today. Physician assisted dying was legalized in Canada in 2016. I'm just wondering, in the light of your experience and kind of engagement with this issue, how you understand the Canadian case as being part of a more generalized trend, even I think you could say a worldwide, yeah, or at least a trend within the global north. Someone has called it a kind of an emerging human rights,
yeah,
norm.
Yeah.
That, yeah, didn't, within this consensus, as we said, didn't exist at the time of the Sue Rodriguez, yeah, case back in the early 1990s, did kind of come into being in the 2000s. So, how maybe you understand the Canadian experience as being part of this broader trend, but also being a little bit unique in terms of some of the numbers. So, yeah. So Quebec, for, yeah, example, I know that the final statistics aren't out, but the trends are the most recent forecasts are pointing to quite a high, a substantial increase in assisted deaths, around 7%. And in general, across Canada, kind of a rise that other countries like the Netherlands, Switzerland, haven't necessarily seen. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot there. There's probably at least three or four questions there. Yeah. So let me begin by this. There's at least two stories in Canada. There's the Canadian story and there's the Quebec story.
Yeah.
And that's because, well, as you know, Quebec, there's a Quebec exceptionalism in a lot of areas of policy, which is rooted in its sense of itself as a sort of independent nation, or as a nation within a nation, as it were, able and entitled to trace its own sort of path in manners different from the rest of Canada. In this case, what happened was the rest of Canada, that the decision to move to medical assistance of dying was very much a court-led process, right? So Rodriguez was decided in 92, I think. That's right.
93.
Yeah, 93. And then the case of Gloria Taylor, which became known as a Carter decision for reasons that are not particularly interesting, but sort of reconsidered it on the basis of the fact that between 92 and 2000 and whatever the decision was handed down, I'm bad with dates, there had been a sufficient number of jurisdictions around the world that had legalized physician assistance in dying, that there was a body of evidence on the basis of which court could answer what had been sort of the question at the top of the court's mind back in 93, which was, can we do this safely? Can we have a regime of medical assistance in dying that would vindicate the rights of people like Sue Rodriguez or Gloria Taylor. But just remember that in 93, the court didn't say that Sue Rodriguez didn't have a right under Section 7, life, liberty, and security, to end her life, get aid from her physician ending her life. It said that that right could be limited by concern with the potential consequences of having a full regime of medical assistance in dying. So what changes is the court looks at the evidence from Belgium, Netherlands, Switzerland, some American states, and says, look, you know, nothing's perfect, but it looks like we can do this safely. And so now the right is vindicated. There's no more counterweight coming from sort of social policy concerns that would outweigh the right. And so, but it was very much a court-led process. Whereas in Quebec, there was a process that was started by two members of the National Assembly from the, what were at the time the two dominant parties, the Parti Québécois and the Liberal Party, that said, look, let's put away our usual ideological differences and have a cross-partisan commission that will just decide, you know, and change the law through the legislature rather than through the courts. There's a little bit of a legal wrangle between Ottawa and Quebec City on the criminal law is the jurisdiction of the federal government. And so on the face of it, Quebec doesn't have the jurisdiction to change the criminal code. The argument that Quebec was getting ready to make, which it never had to make because it was never litigated, was that this is actually not criminal law. This is healthcare, and it should therefore be considered to be part of the provincial jurisdiction. There was a very democratic process in Quebec, which I think was quite exemplary in many ways, of this sort of bipartisan commission that was set up by two very, very, I think, remarkable politicians that kind of, you know, consulted widely with Quebecers and came up with a proposal, which in the end was very similar to what, very little difference between the arrival points of the Canadian process and the Quebec process. But the procedures are very different. So I think the global trend certainly, I think, impacted both processes in the sense that Canadians, I think, saw themselves as getting on a train that was sort of already moving, as opposed to being sort of first off the, you know, first to try this. Canadians have, you know, legalization of cannabis is something where Canada is close to being the sort of vanguard. Uruguay had done it just before, but under conditions that are so restrictive that it hardly counts, it seems to me. Canada is, I think, the first place in the world where you could walk down to the Société Québécoise du Cannabis and buy, you know, perfectly legal cannabis. So it's not that Canada is always shy to be the first off the, but, you know, in this case, I think it didn't want to be. And but I think a lot of people, both legislators in Quebec, the courts probably, and the rest of Canada, saw a movement afoot that was going to lead to this being quite widespread. The interesting thing is that it hasn't been. When we were writing the report and when the law passed, I thought that this would be, you know, Canada, after all, is a country, you know, reasonable Canadians. You know, a lot of people would look at us and say, well, if the Canadians are doing it, maybe we should do it as well. But I've been surprised at the degree to which it just hasn't given rise to a more global adhesion. There are tons of places in which there have been parliamentary commissions or processes that have been set up that have liberalized certain aspects of the end-of-life clinical relationship, so palliative sedation, but not to the point of legalizing and regularizing and to some degree routinizing medical assistance in dying. Let's get back to the numbers. You're right that you know, Quebec has this staggeringly high, I think the number that I saw, the most recent number, is 7.4% of all deaths. Now, there's a question of how do you interpret that number? And there's a question of what you make of that number. I think the question of how you interpret that number, I'm quite certain, has at least something to do with the fact that it had been talked about as much as it had, given the direction, given the procedure that was followed in Quebec, which was not a kind of rarefied, court-driven thing, but something where people were talking about it in their kitchens and, you know, coffee shops because they were being consulted. I think there might also be something about this. Quebec was a one of the most Catholic societies in the world, very much beholden to church teachings and church doctrine. And I think that this is still part of the pendulum swing. So Quebec is the place in the world where people get married the least, right? By actually quite a margin.
I hadn't known that.
Yeah, I think the Swedes are sort of, you know, somewhere, but it's actually staggering. It's not that people don't have committed relationships and actually have common law rights after a certain point of cohabiting, but they don't bother to go down to either the church or even City Hall or whatever to get married. The numbers are actually quite impressive. And I think that the number on physician-assisted dying has to be taken into that context. It's like, you know, of course, until recently, getting married was what you did because the church, or, you know, and you certainly didn't, you know, you lived until God decided that you weren't going to live anymore. So I think that part of it has to do with the democratic nature of the exercise. People talked about it. And also because of, I think, a reaction to church, as strange as it may be. There's also something about, you know, there are stories, right, about, you know, people who have been. So there's a very prominent columnist who writes for La Presse, but also radio, called Patrick Lagacé.
Yeah, I always read his columns.
Yeah. Who wrote a column at some point about a friend of his who had, or an acquaintance of his, I don't think it was a friend, who had decided that he would do medical assisted dying. And Patrick reported on it, you know, as being kind of like this joyous occasion where friends came around and toasted him. And, you know, it's maybe not a great analogy, but, you know, when you think about something like gay marriage, which went from being something that was controversial to being just, yeah, at this point, even the most conservative politician in Canada would be ill-advised to campaign on the basis of reversing gay marriage. It's accepted without, you know, what happens? People at some point go to a gay marriage and they have fun and they realize that, you know, these two people actually love each other and, you know, the son's not going to follow this guy. And it just becomes something that goes from being this scary abstraction to being something that people will witness as being positive. Mm-hmm. And I think medical assisted dying, some of the reports that were written, maybe some of the people who have been identified with it, made people realize, hey, maybe that's the way I would want to go rather than just wasting away in a hospital bed, which is, as we start our report with, you know, for me, it was a staggering statistic that I'm not going to recall the exact number, but the number of people who just die basically in a corner in a hospital bed because they can't go home, they're obviously dying, so people just have to wait for them to, you know, wake themselves out. Half the people in Canada were dying that way. And when you ask people, and this is part of the report as well, how they saw their deaths, ideally, you know, the disconnect between the way people actually die and the way people say that they want to die was just huge. You know, people argue that, well, we've jumped right down the slippery slope and here we are, you know, 7.4% of the population. I say, look, no, it's not like you have extra deaths. These are people who are going to die anyway, and they're choosing to die in this manner that is one that allows them to control the conditions under which they'll die and, you know, maybe to have a kind of a send-off that is more in keeping with the way that they want to confront disease and lead their lives. So the number for me is explainable and not necessarily one that makes me sort of worried that we've gone too far. Just that number. There are other things perhaps that, you know, whether we'll talk about them, but, you know, to do with the extension into earlier ages and things that, you know, you definitely want to think long and hard about those things, advanced directives. But just that sheer number is not something that fills me with anxiety. What does surprise me, and this connects back the dots, is how reticent other societies still are that are culturally and politically quite similar to Canada and Europe, or, you know, to taking this step.
Let me kind of jump in and pick up on some of the stories that we've been following, which by and large, as you say, really are good at capturing the way in which assisted dying does allow people at the end of their lives to create meaning, to contact friends and family, and to think back on what ultimately is a life well lived. But in the Canadian context, and some of these stories have had international residents, there have been, again, one could say empirically not a very high number, but nevertheless existent stories of people. There were two cases, two women who used pseudonyms, Denise and Sophia, who both had something called multiple chemical sensitivities. Yeah. In both cases, and these were cases that went on to be cited in current debates around the forthcoming potential expansion, yeah, of the eligibility of the Canadian law. These cases were cited as people who would have benefited from better housing that allowed them to manage their condition properly, but failing to get that, were quite open in saying, well, you know, effectively poverty and a lack of ability to live well have underpinned my desire to access MAID. Maybe that's the final question I have in the context of this podcast. How do you feel about what I might call a kind of a second wave of stories that highlights some of the, if not a slippery slope, at least the way in which the lived experience of some individuals, as also reflected in their stories, encapsulates some of the failures of the safeguards around MAID to
exploit? Yeah, so I think there's two separate questions in that, and I want to treat them separately because they raise very different issues. So one of the things that we've been hearing a lot, I mean, you know, every set of safeguards, and if you look at the safeguards in the Canadian case and the safeguards that were built into what is referred to as Track 2, which should be put in place in Canada in March, which is the case of people who have mental, psychological, without an underlying physical, strange to talk that way because, you know, we're well beyond the Cartesian dualist world of purely mental, but, you know, people whose illnesses are mental or psychological, the safeguards are quite demanding, but they're never as, they're never going to be more rigorous than the people who hold them or, you know. And, you know, one of the most difficult questions is how much, A, given the fact that we're never going to be able to design a perfect system, how much, you know, violation of those norms are we willing to tolerate before we say we either have to tighten them up? I don't think we'll ever be able to come back completely from our decision to allow it. Now, I think that when, you know, so officially, medical assisted dying is not supposed to be presented by physicians like just some other random medical option, right? It's supposed to come from the patient themselves. The initiative is supposed to be that of the patient. And clearly that's not always happening. Now, my view of those, you know, easier said than done, is that in those cases, I'm giving an analogy. We just legalized cannabis, but that doesn't mean that any cannabis use is legal. The only cannabis use that's legal is actually going down to the Société Québécoise de Cannabis and buying the cannabis that has been and consuming it in, you know, very specified. You can't just, you know, go next to a school and light up a joint. And so if you do it the way that the law prescribes, you are completely immune from prosecution. If you don't, you're committing a crime, and you're committing a crime that's the same as it was before we legalized, right? So I think that the stakes in a way here are just as high. It would be a mistake. So it's probably a mistake if we want to cut down on the illegal drug trade to not crack down on illegal drugs, even if a drug that we have also legalized. It sort of requires of cops and prosecutors that they think out of both sides of their heads. These people, fine. These people are going to have criminal. But I think that there's some sense to it. But even more in the case of medical assistance and dying, we do not want hospital administrations or prosecutors saying, ah, yeah, he really went too far by, but you know what, we've legalized it, so we've let the, so I think that those people should be sanctioned just the same as they would have been under the regime of full criminalization because they are committing a crime. You know, medical assistance of dying is legal within the very exacting framework that has been defined. Now, there's a second question that has to do, and this is for me the most difficult question in a way, maybe it's appropriate that we end with it, which is that people are saying that they want to have medical assistance in dying, not because their disease, you know, is in and of itself, independent of all contextual elements, something that they can't live with. Those, there are a lot of cases are like that. You know, if you're the final throes of bone cancer, there's very little that the rest of the world can do to alleviate your suffering. So it's not an uncommon situation that policy finds itself to say, we wouldn't have to do this if the world were, you know, much better than it is, right? And I think one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, to what degree do we want to, a lot of people who are asking for medical assistance in dying, who probably wouldn't be asking for it, who might not be asking for it if different aspects of our social organization or medical, you know, if we had better palliative care or whatever. But on the other hand, is it ethical to turn to a person who is clearly suffering and not suffering, you know, for some trivial reason, but suffering, look, you know, no, we're not going to give you medical assistance in dying because there is a world that you're not actually going to ever see, right? Because it is, you know, the object of aspiration, which may at some point come about in 50 years or something like that. I don't know. I think there's a point at which our inability to provide people with things that we can provide them with now makes it the case that we should, you know, kind of try to block those kinds of cases. The Carter decision opened the door to medical assisted dying quite widely, right? Because, you know, Lori Taylor was not in imminent risk of dying. So the court basically said that the people who, you know, whose death was maybe foreseeable in a long temporal lapse were still eligible if their suffering met the requirements. The government came up with the initial law on medical assisted in dying, which was much narrower and which had the criterion of reasonable foreseeability, right? So you could get medical assisted in dying if your death is reasonably foreseeable, which came to mean, according to the best medical prognosis, a month or two. You'd be dying anyway. There were two people in Quebec, Couchon and Gledieu, who suffered from severe neurodegenerative diseases, who challenged the law, as we predicted that it would be challenged, because of the gulf between what the federal government had first enacted and a court. And they said, look, you know, this leaves us out. And the decision of the court is one that should bring us within the ambit of the law. And the judge who wrote the decision here in Quebec said, yeah, absolutely right. You know, there's no reason for you guys to be left out. The disability community, understandably, was very upset and concerned with this decision, because these weren't people who were, it's not like the Sue Rodriguez and Gloria Taylor cases, ALS, which has a slow, inexorable trajectory towards death. These were people who had severe motor, you know, living in wheelchairs. I don't know exactly what the prognoses were, but, you know, presumably not necessarily condemned to death, who said, even if we're not sort of slowly sliding towards death as in an ALS case, our level of disability is such that it's incompatible in our own lights with a decent life. Now, the disability community was very concerned about this because it basically said, well, if our society were organized better, right, these disabilities would not be as onerous for the people living them as they are. Possibly true, right? Possibly true. But in this case, the social changes that would have to occur in order for it to affect these two people were probably too far in the future, too sort of utopian in a way, to have an impact on how we react to these two cases. I think in those cases, it would have been cruel to say to them, look, because there is a possible state of the world in which your disabilities are not the source of as much suffering as they are now, we're going to say no to you now. Are we going to change the world so that it reaches that? No, not anytime soon, but sorry. I think it would have been quite cruel, although, you know. So my view is that with respect to these things, we have to realize that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, to use the old, Gerald Ford expression. You know, we can both realize that in the state of the world, such as it is now, despite our best efforts, there may be types of disability not leading directly to death, not reasonable foreseeability of death, that do countenance people, that do qualify people for MAID, even if there's a possible state of the world where, you know, while at the same time try to change the world, right? It shouldn't be the case. So the disability community has a concern, and it's a legitimate concern, that, well, if we can kill them, we're not going to change the world, right? But I think we can have sort of complicated, I mean, I think we have made the world more accessible for people with disabilities in all sorts of ways, and we have to continue to do that whilst realizing that individual cases may not be ones that we can deny access to medical assistance in dying to because of some notional future where the world might be a better place. So, but it's very difficult, and where you exactly draw the line is tough. But I think there's two questions. So the question of, are there people who are there healthcare professionals and doctors who are being a little bit too cavalier? That absolutely yes. And to the extent that they are, they're breaking the law and should be sanctioned. And on the other hand, are we killing people who might not want to die if the world were different? I think the answer is probably yes, but we really have to ask ourselves if the types of changes that would be required in order for their afflictions not to be the source of suffering to the degree that they are things that are within our reach in a manner that makes difference to the cases that we have before us. Although, as I say it, I find it a difficult conclusion to arrive at, but...
Thank you so much, Daniel, for taking the time to talk to us. And I think, in a way, concluding on this kind of open question and the tensions going forward is very, very topical.
We're near a final resolution of where the bounds of admissibility are made are going to be in Canada. Maybe the rest of the world is waiting for us to arrive at a conclusion with respect to, you know, mature minors, advanced directives, medical conditions that don't involve an underlying physical ailment. These are all things that are still fluid.
Yeah, and things that, hopefully we'll be tracking in our project Assisted Lab. But thank you again, and also for being a friend of the lab.
Absolutely, pleasure.
Cette expression de la Convention porte en elle une exigence et une attente. C'est celle d'un modèle français de la fin.
Hemos podido cambiar el final de la historia de muchas personas. Hemos podido dignificar el final de la historia de muchas personas.
Das allgemeine Persönlichkeitsrecht umfasst als Ausdruck persönlicher Autonomie ein Recht auf selbstbestimmte Sterben.
That is not doing justice. We are here to protect the most vulnerable in our society, not to legislate to kill them.
This was Assisted, the podcast.